You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producers Liam and Flo. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For Dear Science this week, our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern, speaks with us about AI spotting pancreatic cancer, fetal surgery, and Yellowstone. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with Ryan Hamilton about the emails between Foreign Minister Winston Peters and Prime Minister Christopher Luxon released last week, what they mean for growing tensions and instability within the coalition, and proposed changes to treaty obligations that would see Te Tiriti only need to be taken into account. Liam, what do you have for us today?
Hi, Alex. For Green World today, I spoke with Max Harvey from the University of Otago about his recent research study on the habitat usage of the Hector's dolphin, the research they carried out in Southland, what they discovered, and what it tells us about how we can better look after this dolphin species. I also spoke to Professor Sally Gore from the University of Canterbury about the government's new rules to reduce the amount of lead in drinking water pipes, what this means for New Zealand, and why it was not done soon.
And Flo, what do you have for us today?
Kia ora, Alex. I spoke to Dr. Lucy Goodman, a researcher at the University of Auckland School of Optometry and Vision Science, about her study into accessible eye health and potential for government funding of eye care in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
He aha o whakaaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware, e āhe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēne kōrero āno, hei pakehere roki roki mā runga i te pai, tuku tuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia timata te whakatūranga, let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science today, we are joined by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern.
Kia ora.
What has science got for us today?
A little bit of a medical theme today with some volcanoes added in.
A great mix.
So first off, we're going to talk about the pancreas and pancreatic cancer. So most of us probably know the word pancreas, but we might not know what it does, right? And so it's part of the digestive system. It's basically where the digestive juices or the enzymes that are produced that help break down our food when we eat it, and also it produces insulin, which controls the levels of sugar in our blood. And it can obviously become cancerous. So there's a couple of types of cancer. There's pancreatic adenocarcinoma, which is what people mostly get, and this is when the cells that produce those food enzymes become cancerous, and the other one's neuroendocrine, or pancreatic neuroendocrine, which is when the cells that are producing insulin become cancerous. But what's really devastating about pancreatic cancer is that it means you're going to die. And the overall 5-year survival rate is just 12%. So this means that if 1,000 people get diagnosed, 12% of those are going to be dead within 5 years. And this is largely because we don't see it until it's too late. It's spread. And so what this study was all about was using AI and CT scans to kind of change this. And so they've developed this AI model called REDMOD, which is radiomics-based early detection. And so with any AI, you've got to train it. So you need a data set to train on. And so they were able to collect together 936 CT scans. Most of these came from healthy people. So there was 813 control samples. But then what's really cool is that they were able to get 156 CT scans from people pre-diagnosis. So these people went on to develop pancreatic cancer in the next between 3 months and 3 years' time. So they were getting CT scans probably for other reasons. So these aren't easy data sets to collect together. And what they were using these CT scans, they weren't looking for tumours. They were looking for changes in the tissue texture or the structure that are often too subtle for our human eye to see, because, you know, like once we see the tumour in this case, it's maybe too late, or, you know, sometimes they can be cut out. But really they were looking for this very, very early on diagnosis, because when you get cancer, often what's happened is that your normal cells have actually acquired some DNA mutation that affects how they grow and divide, and this is where, you know, you get these tumours develop and your cancer. So they developed their model, and then with all AI, it really comes down to the testing that tells you how good it's working. So you have a new data set. And so they had CT scans from 63 people that went on to get pancreatic cancer, so the same conditions as what was used in the training set. And this AI actually identified 73% of those people as going on to develop the cancer, which is actually pretty good. That's 3 out of 4. They had compared this to 2 specialist radiographers, and their hit rate was about 40%. So the AI was doing significantly better. And we also should keep in mind that these CTs that they were looking at, just radiographers had looked at these and said, you know, they'd never seen signs of pancreatic cancer. They looked fine in that regard. They weren't looking for it necessarily, but there was nothing obvious there. So it really does show kind of this AI has quite some value in this space. Now, they did also test it on 430 healthy people, because, you know, is the AI just telling us everyone has pancreatic cancer? That's not so useful, right? And what they had in this case is, of those 430, it did actually say 81 of these people might develop pancreatic cancer. But you can also go and do other testing, right? So it's not that this is the only test. So it's kind of, it's sometimes better to be a little bit overzealous in identifying, potentially developing it, test it some other way.
Like a flagging.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, yeah. So, and, you know, they went on to test it on a couple of other data sets that they got from other hospitals using different equipment, just to show that it wasn't unique to their set of CT scans, and it had similar levels of performance. So it's kind of, there's obviously, they need to add data to make it a more diverse population, because it was within the US, these studies. But, you know, like, you can imagine if you're at a high risk of potentially developing pancreatic cancer due to risk factors or family history and stuff, you know, there's a way that, you know, you can now, or potentially in the future, have these CTs done and they check.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, you know, it's usually good to catch cancer early, so that's exciting.
Yeah, no, and particularly, like, this is the one, pancreatic cancer is really is the one where, you know, as soon as someone says, I've been diagnosed with it, you're like, oh, no. You're like, you very often, very short time spans that you're talking about, so it is really cool.
Awesome. What else? What's next in the world of science?
The next is the story of baby Cassian, who was born in August last year, and this is, I had never realised that they did surgery on fetuses. And so when I saw the story, I was kind of blown away. And so baby Cassian, in the second trimester of his mother's pregnancy with him, there was an ultrasound done. And what they noticed was his lungs were overinflated and they were compressing on his heart. And this is a sign of a condition called congenital high airway obstruction syndrome. It has the abbreviation CHAOS. And it basically happens when a fetus is developing, the lungs have these secretions that they'll travel up the windpipe and then we swallow them, get rid of them kind of thing. And this is just part of development. But what can happen in some babies is the windpipe has a blockage, so then these secretions can't get out. They basically swell the lungs, it compresses the heart, and it's just bad. It happens in about 1 in every 50,000 pregnancies, so not super common. And because it's kind of infrequent, there's no sort of standard single method of care. So it's very much dependent on where the baby's at, where the mum's at, as to what they do. But if you don't treat it, it is fatal. And so often what the doctors will do is they'll try and wait to see, or they hopefully the mum and bub can make it to 37 to 39 weeks, so pregnancy is 40 weeks long, And they do this variant of cesarean section. So they half deliver the baby first. So they'll deliver the head, neck and shoulders, but they keep the lower half in the womb. And what this means is that the baby's not breathing necessarily itself yet. It's still getting nutrients and stuff from mum. And then they can insert a catheter to bypass this blockage. So a catheter just being a tube, they can drain out the fluid. The baby can then breathe, and they can then clamp the umbilical cord and deliver the baby like normal. Now, this is called an ex utero intrapartum treatment, abbreviated to EXIT, which I thought was really appropriate. But only like 3 out of 4 of these babies will actually reach these final weeks of pregnancy. 1 in 4 will not and pass away. And that's what was going to happen probably in Cassian's case, where his heart was just being compressed too much. It wasn't going to grow, and it was going to lead to development problems. And obviously, his parents did not want this. And so they basically said to the medical team, is there anything you can do? We're willing to take the risk. And if you can learn anything from this, even better. So the medical team came up with a somewhat extreme, in some ways, idea where they were going to do this exit procedure. But instead of delivering baby Cassian, they were going to put him back in the womb to leave him there to keep cooking, ostensibly. So at 25 weeks, they basically half-delivered Cassian. So they, again, exposing the head and neck, put this catheter into the windpipe, down into the windpipe, drained those lung secretions. But then they actually left the catheter there using a balloon to keep it in place, and then put Cassian back in the wound, sewed everything up, and Mum continued on till 31 weeks when Cassian had to be delivered, because this was major surgery, so often you don't get a full-length pregnancy. But what makes this so... That's kind of amazing anyway, that you can do this. But it's also, when you consider the risks involved, it's pretty extreme. Like, you need to obviously keep mum and baby going. And so what they did was they used general anaesthesia, so completely knocked out both, whereas usually in a cesarean section, it's regional, so like the lower half gets numbed, but mum's still awake. They had to do this. Basically, the first thing was they couldn't have the baby try breathe, because when you're in utero, you're getting oxygen from the placenta. So there's this blood vessel, basically, that brings in oxygenated blood. It bypasses the lungs because your lungs aren't developed yet, so you can't oxygenate that blood yourself. And that's how you get oxygenated blood around your body. Now, as soon as that fetus tries to breathe, that blood vessel starts closing up. Like, it's the signal to the body, like, things are changing. So they really needed this baby not to breathe, because they wanted to put it back into the womb to continue development. So that's why that was general anaesthesia for the baby, but we don't really know what that does at 25 weeks, so they're going to have to monitor this kid for a while to see if there's any effects long term. And then with the mum, Kashira, who, when the uterine wall muscles are cut, their natural instinct is to contract. Now you contract to get rid of it, to like eject the baby, basically, which is, again, we didn't want happening. So they used a general anaesthetic to completely numb everything, so that wouldn't happen. And also, when that contraction happens, it's a lot of blood loss. So they didn't want that either, because they were wanting her to remain obviously as healthy as possible with all her blood, so that the baby could continue to develop in utero. And then the final thing was, they used this balloon catheter and they left it in there, but they had to get the inflation exactly right, because if they underinflated, it would slip down and then put pressure on the windpipe. If it overinflated, it could compress nerve blood vessels so that they weren't getting drainage out of the head and everything. So they all signed up. They managed to get it all right. The baby did make it to 31 weeks. So it was still preemie. It still had to stay in the hospital for several months, stay on a ventilator to help it breathe. But it is, they report that baby Cassian will be off the ventilator soon. They're trying to wean him off. But he does still have to go under surgery to get rid of this blockage that caused all the problems in the first place.
But all things considered, right.
Amazing.
That's a lot better than the alternative.
Yeah, and it turns out there's a few different types of these fetal surgeries that get done. There's ones where they call open, which was what this is a case of, where they kind of open things up and they do stuff. But then there's like different, they call it fetoscopic. So, you know, like we have keyhole surgeries and they do stuff like that. And they put in shunts and they do other interventions. So it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I've never considered that this is a thing that we could do. But now that I know that it might be a thing we could do, it feels like there's a lot that
could be done. Yeah. Yeah,
with kind of circumventing some of these issues at this specific stage of development, which is hopeful.
Yeah, it is, and it's major respect to the surgeons and these medical teams involved, right? Like when they delivered baby Cassie in, they had like 30 people around to like just be on ready to like do this exit surgery, sort of, in all this sort of stuff. Because of course, when he was born, like because he still had this catheter in. They used it to drain what fluid was still there, but then they used it to ventilate him as well for his breathing because he started breathing himself. And yeah, it's just.
Love a hopeful medical story. But yeah, awesome. Well, moving out of the medical world
to earth sciences.
What's our last topic for today?
So Yellowstone, it's a super volcano. It's basically where Yellowstone is. The Earth's crust is quite thin, relatively thin to other parts of the planet. And it turns out, I didn't realize this, in the last 2.1 million years, there's been three major eruptions in the area of Yellowstone. The most recent being 631,000 years ago, which created the caldera that it's known for.
Yeah.
What's interesting about Yellowstone is that there's a bit of a debate around the origins of its volcanic activity. So whether it's what's called got a deep mantle plume beneath the surface. So basically a mantle plume is just super hot material that rises from the Earth's mantle starting at the like core mantle boundary. So it's super hot material that's, you know, heating up the magma that's the volcanic under the crust there for the volcanic activity. The other method that could be leading to its volcanic origins is all about pressures within the crust and the mantle, so tectonic plates, which we well know here in New Zealand. And so this study's just come out that points towards that it's due to tectonic activity. Why we care about this is because it will affect kind of future predictions about what the area will do and what its volcanic activity is.
And typically you want to know if a super volcano is going to do something.
Might be nice, right? So what they did was they basically built a new three-dimensional model where they incorporated past tectonic movements around the Western Northern America, present-day mantle structure, and then data about the lithosphere. So the lithosphere is basically the Earth's hard rocky crust, so the outer bit. And they were basically trying to figure out what's the magma plumbing under Yellowstone, like how's it controlled? And so what they discovered with this modeling is that there's basically two opposing forces pulling at the system. So they have the lithosphere under Yellowstone, so this hard rocky crust. There's actually different densities around this area, and so what this causes is that basically the crust to stretch. So the scientists use the analogy of it's like stretching dough, right? And so it's moving towards the western coast of the US. But then at the same time, you have this older tectonic plate that's sinking below the central eastern North America. So it's sinking below and it's dragging the bottom of the crust downward and it's tilting the volcanic plumbing system. So you've kind of got these two forces that are competing, and so they're kind of pulling the lithosphere apart. And so this is kind of connecting this hot material closer to the surface. And so this is where you get your magma plumbing just below that crust, and so that's why you're kind of getting all this volcanic activity. And what's kind of cool about this as well is that there was a another scientist that wasn't involved in the study had talked about in the thing that I was reading, there'd been this recent study saying that the magma in the area would originate from the southwest of the area in the upper mantle just below the lithosphere, and then it would migrate to the northeast below the caldera. So they had, I don't know how they worked this out, but they had worked this out. But they didn't know why, and this model actually kind of explains why this could happen. And so they're basically saying, they didn't make any predictions about the future, but they're going, this could help with making predictions in the future. And then they're also saying, like, it could be used to understand other areas and such. And so being a somewhat volcanic country, maybe this has some interest to us. Yeah,
it would be nice to know. We got too many volcanoes to let that slip through our fingers. But anyway, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks, Kushla, for joining us. Thank you, Motet, and thank you, Science. Find out what the future of fitness looks like at Sports Tech, 23rd and 24th of May, a whole weekend of fun activities focused on the innovative world of sports technology.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Aldous Harding has pulled into the station with phenomenal new album Train on the Island, and we have copies of the vinyl to give away to B-card holders. So stay on board the breakfast wagon all week for your cue to enter. Aldous Harding, Train on the Island, out this Friday via Flying Nun Records and Where All Good Music Is Found.
It's music!
You can listen to us while you're at home doing some chores, or you can take us along for company while you're driving in your car.
Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, publicised tension between the governing coalition members continued to grow as Foreign Minister Winston Peters released emails from Prime Minister Christopher Luxon from immediately after the beginning of the US-Israeli war in Iran, which seemed to show the Prime Minister considering an explicitly pro-US stance. Since the release of the emails, Luxon has said the emails mischaracterized his position and accused Peters of playing politics, while Peters has since apologized and chalked the release down to an error. The row has, however, sparked a range of voices commenting on the perceived conflict between the two parties. Looking forward to this year's election. Tensions have also popped up last week between the ACT Party and NZ First after the two parties disagreed over each other's immigration policies. Last week also saw the reveal of proposed changes to treaty obligations. The changes would make it so the required level of engagement with Te Tiriti across government decisions would be to take the treaty into account. I spoke with National Party MP Ryan Hamilton about these topics, starting with the released emails. Last week, following what were already tensions between some of the coalition partners, we saw the release of emails between the Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Winston Peters that seemingly displayed a pro-US stance on the Iran war from the Prime Minister in the days after the conflict started. What is the National Party stance on what was said and Peters releasing them to begin with?
What was said was what was said in the OIAs. I mean, I don't think there's further comment that's needed. Mr. Peters seemed to change his perspective a couple of times, but in our view, he acknowledged that releasing those emails was a process mistake.
Luxon has accused Peters of playing politics, and as you've said, Peters has acknowledged error in the releasing of the emails. But where does this leave the relations kind of between these two prominent politicians, especially on such a hot-button issue?
Oh, I think, you know, as we've talked about in other weeks, Alex, too, I mean, you know, Winston Peters is a unique personality. He's, you know, autonomous in his own right as a leader, and he will say and do things that he's entitled to. And in an election year, there's going to be, I guess, distinctions made between the parties. But on the whole, I think New Zealand First supporters, National supporters, would still much rather have a coalition of the three parties than the alternative.
Former National Minister and MP Chris Finlayson has last week called on the party to declare war on New Zealand First, recommending that the National Party distance themselves from the party leading up to this election. Where does the National Party sit on these comments and potential concerns going into this election about coalition making?
Well, Mr. Finlayson is entitled to those views, as is everyone else, and often previous ministers and, you know, party members will have particular leanings or views or comments that the media quite like to give a platform to. But ultimately, we've still got, 5 months before the election or before Parliament rises. So it's important that we maintain, you know, cohesive government and continue to focus on the legislative agenda, which has got, policy that's led by National and policy that's led by the other parties. So I'm sure all of us will be, whilst we're starting to make distinctions in terms of party brand, I don't think there's any intention at all to disrupt status quo before the election and campaign proper. And I think that's when you'll start to see, I wouldn't use the term war, but I think you'll start to see, you know, parties start to fly their colours a bit more distinctly.
Looking outside of the National Party to the other two members of the coalition, the ACT Party and NZ First have now traded barbs over their respective immigration policy. Should New Zealanders take this as a sign that future coalitions with both of these parties may run into disagreements?
Yeah, I mean, all these things are all normal and natural before an election. I think parties will try and, you know, again, find those distinctions that resonate with their followers. But, you know, ultimately, you know, post the election, post ballot day, that's when, you know, the rubber hits the road in terms of working through these issues. We've done it successfully under Prime Minister Chris Luxon previously, and I'm sure we'll be able to navigate those issues, you know, and those permutations when they come to the fore post November 7.
And Immigration Minister Erica Stanford has criticised what she labelled as knee-jerk policies in the complex sector of immigration. Is this the minister calling the policies by both of these parties knee-jerk?
I don't have the context to which she was referring to, but what I can say is, you know, she's very across the portfolio and it is highly complex and there's lots of nuance and, passageways for different people depending on skill sets, timelines and those sorts of things. And I don't have any doubt that, you know, the other parties will be looking to find niche immigration policies that resonate and it might spark up some interest. But as I say, that's natural, this part of the election cycle, and those things will have to get worked through as, once New Zealand's had their say on voting day.
And kind of looking towards that election then, when it comes to, you know, farther down the line, when these governments, as you said, these parties, sorry, as you said, kind of start showing their colours more, when can we kind of expect to see some sort of kind of positioning, especially if trying to maintain the stability of the coalition? When can we expect these sort of disagreements to be addressed fully?
Well, I think you're already starting to see them come to the surface, and I think it's only natural that they're going to be more and frequent, as we get towards those dates. I think the real campaign period, once Parliament rises mid-September, I think that's when you'll start to see a little bit more clarity and, I guess, forcefulness around those policy positions. That's what it's all about. Politics is really the battle of ideas. But our job as a centre-right national-led government is to ensure if New Zealanders want stability, then a party vote for National is the only way to really secure that. So we'll be working hard to make sure our message is clear and get through, and they're not just, you know, going after a populist vote or a niche part of the community, but something that can take middle New Zealand through in a sustainable way.
And with that said, and just to wrap this topic up, does the National Party believe that this coalition is still stable?
100%.
Now, moving onwards, the government has seemingly begun to push changes to government obligations to Te Tiriti or Waitangi that would limit the influence of Te Tiriti on ministries to simply take into account the treaty. What is the government trying to achieve with these changes?
I think consistency. So, you know, the last 20 years, Parliament's passed a range of laws with all manners of reference to Te Tiriti or treaty, and generally it's been interpreted different ways with different results from, you know, local councils, mana whenua across the country. And so they've all been reviewed to try and ensure that they're specific and consistent. And obviously that's also a big part of the RMA reform, where we're making sure that all treaty settlements are implicitly and explicitly included, because they've already been settled by the Crown, but trying to provide clarity for those that haven't, so there's more of a pathway. And in terms of the existing legislation outside of that, the government's obviously conducted, well, through an advisory group, a process, and they've now come forward with a bunch of recommendations. And those recommendations are now being consulted with iwi leaders across the country before any legislation or decision making is complete. So there is a process underway to try and find a way forward in that.
And what would the National Party say to concerns that maybe these changes are looking to lessen the impact and the influence of Te Tiriti?
I'd say the purpose of what we're trying to do is create consistency and clarity. And, you know, that would be true on non-iwi and for iwi, because even the way it's interpreted across iwi throughout the country is different, across different rohi and different interpretations. So it's really to try and find that pathway forward that will benefit both Māori and non-Māori going forward in a sustainable way.
And just finally, this government has already seen the highly controversial Treaty Principles Bill kind of get its moment in the sun and then ultimately not make it. Where does government kind of sit on comparing this bill in regards to changes to the more controversial Treaty Principles Bill?
I think that was, you know, from the get-go, was always highly controversial. It was, you know, linked very definitely to the ACT Party, and it was part of the coalition agreement, and we always knew it was going to be bumpy. I think this is far more nuanced, and there is, you know, direct consultation going on, as I said, with iwi. So obviously we're hopeful that we can find a pathway forward that's enduring and that's palatable for all sides, you know, all sides of the equation.
That was National Party MP Ryan Hamilton on continued tension between NZ First, the National Party and ACT, and changes to treaty obligations.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
What's this button do? Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
Hector's dolphins are Aotearoa's only endemic dolphin species, and play an important role in New Zealand's marine ecosystems. As a result of human interference, primarily from fishing bycatch and pollution, the species has seen a drastic reduction in numbers and is currently endangered. Low numbers and lack of genetic diversity have added further strains, with the species being a key target of conservation efforts. I spoke with Max Harvey, a marine scientist from the University of Otago, and the lead researcher on a recent paper demonstrating the use of acoustic monitoring to study Hector's dolphins' habitat usage in Southland's Porpoise Bay. We discussed the research he carried out as part of his master's, what it tells us about Hector's dolphins, and how we can better coexist with this unique species. So to set the scene, Hector's dolphins, what are they? Why are they important in New Zealand? And I guess, why are they your favourite type of dolphin?
So Hector's dolphins are an endemic small dolphin species. So that means they're only found in New Zealand. They grow to about 1.5 metres long, so they're the smallest dolphin species in the world, and they are one of the rarest as well. They're really important ecologically in New Zealand, so they act as one of the top predators within marine ecosystems, and they also act as prey for other more top predators than them. And yeah, they're just an amazing little creature. Yeah, stoked to have been able to work with them, and therefore they are my favourite dolphin species.
Yeah, and so what did you do in your research, and what were the main findings with regards to the behaviour and population structure of these dolphins?
This specific research that was published this year was one chapter out of my master's thesis. So more broadly, that thesis was updating the estimate of abundance of Hector's dolphins that use this small bay called Porpoise Bay down in the Catlins, so basically the bottom of the South Island, the southeast of the South Island. So we estimated the abundance We looked at habitat use using passive acoustic monitoring, and we also looked at the effects of recreational swimmers on the population. So for context, the Department of Conservation had concerns about the number of visitors to the bay that may or may not be interacting with the dolphins outside of the dolphins' terms. So what I mean by that is that people turning up to the bay and approaching dolphins directly from shore, because sometimes these dolphins in this particular bay are swimming in only, you know, a meter or meter and a half of water, so very easily approachable. But from Doc's point of view and from a conservation point of view, we want any interactions with dolphins to be on the dolphins' terms. So they were concerned that people were having an impact, and they wanted to know more about that. So the research that we recently published was using echolocation detectors, so kind of similar to hydrophones, underwater microphones. And this allowed us to continuously monitor these two locations within the bay for echolocation clicks. And so Hector's dolphins, their echolocation clicks are ultrasonic. So they sit in this roughly 125 to 130 kilohertz range, which is outside of human hearing. So these echolocation detectors, they work in all sighting conditions and when the animals are not at the surface, so when they're underwater, which provide this key advantage over previous research that used visual sightings. Our key findings were that we confirmed that the dolphins preferred this southwest corner of the bay, and that particular area of the bay is shallow. It's less than about 10 meters depth. It's sheltered from the predominant southwest swell and presumably gives some kind of advantage, energetic kind of advantage for the dolphins using that area, as opposed to the more exposed area sort of towards the middle of the bay. So spatially, that was the sort of key finding. And then temporally, we found that the dolphins were echolocating from about 5 in the morning till about 9 at night. And then throughout that 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. period, very, very few detections. So what that is probably due to is that the dolphins are leaving the monitored area. So they're probably leaving the bay at night and then using the bay predominantly as a daytime habitat. And we also found some really cool effects of tidal state on the dolphins' echolocation behavior. So the sort of the highest detections were around high tide, and the lowest detections, relatively speaking, were around low tide. And what these relate to most likely is foraging opportunities. So probably as the tide comes in, what's happening is that's bringing in potential prey. And so the animals are feeding on this potential prey, or at least attempting to feed closer to that high tide period. And we also found throughout a 5-day period of fieldwork in winter that the dolphins were there. So that was a key knowledge gap identified in previous studies, was what is their winter use like? And although we had quite a small sample size, we were able to confirm that at least some dolphins are using that habitat during the winter. So yeah, some really cool results there. And we were able to kind of differentiate between occurrence, so kind of all echolocation clicks, and then make these echolocation clicks into, we were looking specifically, sorry, at foraging clicks. So these really, really fast, rapid clicks. So they have a very small, what's called inter-click interval, less than about 8 milliseconds between clicks. And what that tells us is that the dolphin's echolocation target is very, very close to them. And based on previous studies, we assume that this is the dolphins in their closing phase of their prey capture attempt. So very, very close to a prey. And we were able to use that information to then, alongside occurrence, so all echolocation clicks, we were able to look at specifically foraging. And that basically matched the same patterns that I just described before. So very, very cool stuff.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, was it what you expected to discover?
Didn't really have expectations outside of the spatial distribution. So previous boat-based surveys were able to go throughout the whole bay. Bearing in mind, Porpoise Bay is a relatively small bay. It's about 4 kilometers squared. So the spatial stuff was not a massive surprise, but the time of day, so the diurnal cycle and the tidal cycle and the winter stuff, that was all a surprise. We had no preconceived ideas of what that would be like.
Yeah. And where are the dolphins when they're not in that bay?
That's a great question. So when they're outside of Porpoise Bay, we have very limited understanding as to where they go. Over the years, there have been aerial surveys as part of the broader dock and Fisheries New Zealand management, as part of the threat management plan, as a part of understanding their sort of along shore and offshore distribution throughout the country, but also, you know, specifically for the Catlins Coast. So we know that they're going out at least sort of 15 nautical miles off the coast, so 25 to 30 kilometers off the coast down there. And within that Catlins Coast area, they're also using what's called Toi Toi's Bay. So that's further west, just to the east of Bluff. Mm-hmm. And the broader population that Porpoise Bay dolphins sit within ranges all the way along that coast. So on a daily basis, when they leave the bay in the evenings, We don't know where they're going, but outside of that small bay, that could be that they're just around the corner. It could be that they're going further offshore to feed. The most likely explanation is that they're following prey, but we don't know yet.
Yeah. And how can this research be used to sort of inform conservation efforts? And how can it tell us how we can better coexist with dolphins?
So this research, it's purely at this stage, the questions that we were answering were ecological questions. If we were to sort of translate that into some sort of management measures, or at least guiding management measures, we might look at when are the peak foraging times within the daily cycle. And that seems to be sort of early morning and mid-afternoon. So if we wanted to manage people better, to not interrupt those foraging behaviors, we could target those times. But really what this research is, it's a stepping stone within our broader understanding of Hector's dolphins in Porpoise Bay. So what we are really saying at the end of the day is that we know that it's an important foraging area. We know that from previous studies, including my master's, that mothers and calves are frequently found in the bay. And based on this importance, this perceived importance, we should be letting people know that come to the bay and try to swim with them. Basically, if you're going to get into the water, follow the guidelines that are already in place. So enter the water at least 50 meters away from dolphin groups, and do not swim with dolphin groups containing mums and calves. The reason for the latter is because Hector's dolphins, being small, warm-blooded mammals that live in a relatively cool environment relative to their body temperature, they have really high metabolic rates. So they're constantly having to feed in order to maintain their internal body temperature and all that kind of thing. So interruptions to those critical behaviors like foraging, and then also for the mums and calves for nursing, over time, those can have cumulative impacts on, say, juvenile survivorship, on their fitness, and all those kinds of sort of more broad scale ecological concepts. So it's really important that people follow these guidelines when they're down in the bay. And that's what we're kind of trying to stress from what we now know from this research.
Yeah, if this research keeps going, what do you hope future research will uncover? And is there new technologies? Is there scope for a broader study?
That's a, again, really good question. It's a common theme of your questions.
Thank you.
My understanding is that next year, the Department of Conservation is planning to do some genetic testing of the dolphins in the Catlins population. So there's a need to resolve the connectivity between the South Coast and the East Coast regional populations. In the past, we've understood that the Catlins acts as this bridge between South and East Coasts. But research in the last couple of years has shown that potentially it's Dunedin that is the main bridge between South and East Coast. So we want to know, from last year, they did some biopsy sampling of Dunedin dolphins, and now they want to do the Catlins Coast population and see how connected they are. And that can inform things like management units. So should we be having a fisheries bycatch limit for the whole of the South Coast, or are some of these populations like the Catlins and Dunedin genetically unique enough that they should be managed as their own separate unit? So that would be really good to know. And then further from that, just expanding the boat-based surveys or aerial surveys as well throughout the Catlins Coast to get a better idea of how many dolphins there are more broadly in the population and whereabouts they're going, how much overlap they have with potential threats like trawling and gillnets. So those are the kind of key questions going from here, as well as continuing long-term monitoring of sort of recreational swimmer or tourism pressure within Porpoise Bay would be really good.
And how did this project come about?
So this project was kind of part luck and part persistence. So the backstory was that I was just kind of cold approaching different potential supervisors for my master's. And on this particular day, I spoke to a professor and asked him if he had space for a master's project, to which he said no. And then I asked him if he had considered this summer studentship with Doc. And he said, oh, I actually spoke about that today and making it into a master's project. So I said, who do I talk to? And then went to the next person who ended up being my my primary supervisor and pestered him for a couple of weeks, a couple of months, and then eventually just sort of slotted into the lab group. So I guess the key lesson or key takeaway there for any prospective master's students or PhD students or any undergrads looking for opportunities is to to network, to talk to people, volunteer, and yeah, hopefully eventually opportunities will find their way to you.
That was the University of Otago's Max Harvey speaking about his research on the Hector's dolphin in Southland.
That was The Green World.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Eye health in New Zealand is not covered by any government subsidies, making it very expensive and inaccessible, especially for poor people. Researchers from the School of Optometry and Vision Science at the University of Auckland have conducted a study on the financing of eye health in New Zealand and explored possibilities to help those most affected by the costs. Comparing the situation to Australia, but focusing on specific options for Aotearoa New Zealand, I spoke to lead researcher Dr. Lucy Goodman about the study.
I'm Lucy Goodman. I'm a research fellow in the community eye health team at the University of Auckland.
Thank you so much. So, yeah, you've recently released a study regarding the affordability of eye care in New Zealand. What motivated you to engage in the study?
Well, as a team, we're researching the ways that we can improve access to eye care, because at the moment in New Zealand, there's very little public funding to help people to access eye exams and glasses. So if you need to see an optometrist, you need to pay for it yourself, and that can be really expensive. So what that means is currently eye care is a luxury, not a right. So the people who are experiencing vision loss are those who can't afford to pay for it, and it shouldn't be like that. So to change that, we're trying to provide some evidence that policymakers can use so that they might consider including eye care within the health budget.
But so why is there no government subsidy of such a widespread health condition that affects so many?
That's a great question. I think the reason is probably mostly historical, that we've just overlooked it. So if we compare ourselves to Australia, they have a universal eye care policy. They aim to address vision loss before it becomes an issue. We're at the other end of the scale where we're not addressing eye problems before they become a problem. So we're waiting until people end up in hospital with irreversible vision loss. I think the reason about why our government hasn't addressed this earlier is more about the New Zealand government has overlooked eyes and eye health, but it's very important, and it's time that we take a closer look at including eyes in our health budget the same way that Australia does.
I mean, especially as you said that rather than being preventative, I guess our systems currently just deal with the consequences. I mean, I'm guessing a case could also be made that prevention is probably actually cheaper than when these issues are actually very, very large and intense to deal with.
Absolutely. So the cost of vision loss is significant. Globally, it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars. In New Zealand, we have lots of people living with vision loss that could have been avoided, and these do have costs for those individuals, but as well as for our society. So if we could address or provide services that people could access in the community to prevent vision loss from occurring, this would have long-term cost savings for our economy.
I guess it's one of those political situations where having to pay up front is something that a lot of governments tend not to like. Yeah, in a way, it's a bit ridiculous because the economic gains would be quite large in the long run.
Eye care, because it's so underfunded in New Zealand, is kind of like a blank slate. There's significant inequities in access to services, and therefore that the outcomes are experienced more by people who can't pay for services. So for a policymaker who's wanting to make an impact on reducing health inequities, eye care could be the way to go.
You'd also mentioned that Māori and Pacific people are 2 to 3 times less likely to have access to eye care services, so those discrepancies in care are quite visible within the eye care sector as well.
Yes, that's right. So that's based on some previous research that's looked across all the types of studies that have been done, and we can see that Māori and Pacific or the healthcare system is set up in a way that makes it more difficult for Māori and Pacific to access eye care services as they're currently delivered. Ideally, if we were to fund eye care in New Zealand, we don't necessarily copy the Australian model. We could deliver targeted approaches that allow people who can't access services to reach care, and this would include Māori and Pacific populations.
Right, essentially because, as you said, it is a blank slate. So rather than copying Australia's model, we could find our own methods of introducing funding and support.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess there's different ways that we could do that, and that will require more discussion. But just for our paper, we've just made a preliminary look at what it would cost if we targeted funding towards specific groups. So as I mentioned, the people who are less likely to access services are those who can't afford it. So we could target services towards community services cardholders, for example. This would be a more targeted approach to reach the people who need public funding.
Politically, often dental care is mentioned that isn't subsidised or covered by the government. But it seems that, forgive the pun, but there's a bit of a blind eye being turned towards eye health. And I just haven't heard it being spoken about in a political sense before. But why do you think there is that? There's not much of a media or political focus on it.
I think dentistry is currently in the media a lot, and they're talking about the possibility of public funding. For vision, I think it's simply because, no, we haven't stood up and said we need this. But eyes and teeth, for some reason, have historically not been included within our sort of core healthcare system, and it doesn't make any sense. Eyes are really important. You need to be able to see well to help you live your life. So you need to be able to, or good vision helps you to learn, to get a job, to drive, to live independently, so many things. But for some reason, we've just overlooked this as something that we have to pay for.
Thinking of the economic standpoint again, that obviously poor eye care also stops people from working or being able to work. I'm guessing especially when these conditions are very dire and very far down the line that people essentially can't do a lot of jobs that they could do if they could see properly.
Absolutely. There's been some global studies about the economic impact from lost productivity, I guess, and they're in the hundreds of billions of dollars. So if we could address progressive eye disease before it leads to vision loss, then we can allow people to achieve the education they need, to get the jobs they need, and overall just lift the productivity of our country.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Cheers. That was Dr. Lucy Goodman from the School of Optometry and Vision Science at the University of Auckland on eye health financing in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Last week, the government announced new rules to transition the country to lead-free plumbing. The new law would ban the use of lead from drinking water pipes in new builds and renovations, and would require all pipes in contact with drinking water to contain less than 0.25% lead. Lead has long been known to be a neurotoxin and has negative effects on human development, and this move has been welcomed by experts as a way of improving New Zealanders' health. I spoke to Professor Sally Gore from the School of Physical and Chemical Sciences at the University of Canterbury about the new regulations, what this means for our health, and why a ban on lead drinking water pipes was not implemented sooner. I expect I was not the only one that was surprised to discover New Zealand did not have a ban on lead in drinking water pipes. Why has it taken this long for one to be implemented?
And that's a very good question. A lot of people felt that this really needed to be done earlier. And if you go back sort of into sort of the early sort of 2020s, there were recommendations that this should happen. There was the out of Dunedin, there was the incident where there was concern about elevated lead in drinking water, and that was sourced back to a tap. So this has been a known issue for a while, and they did reduce the limit for lead in tapware, but now they've brought it down to sort of lead-free or as lead-free as possible.
Yeah, and how extensive is the use of lead in New Zealand plumbing, and have there been many cases of illness?
Well, that we don't know. If you get lead poisoning, it is a notifiable disease, so that does actually need to be notified to the Medical Office of Health and the Ministry of Health, but we don't always have that data. It's known that a lot of New Zealand water is slightly corrosive, so if there is lead in your plumbing, it can be released into drinking water. And the lead can either be in the brass fitting, so quite often there was lead in brass, and that was a key source. Those are the fittings that the plumber sort of uses to connect all the pipework together. But more recently, there have been issues with imported tapware actually containing lead in the tap itself. And the problem is if your water sits there for a while and it's slightly corrosive, it will leach out enough lead. And we need to keep our exposure to lead as low as possible. There really is no safe dose for lead exposure that has not been able to be identified, and because it accumulates in people over time. So if, as the drinking water is just sitting there overnight, or there's a longer time, then that lead's just leaching out into the drinking water.
Could you tell us a bit more about the dangers that lead poses in our drinking water?
Well, lead is a neurotoxin, so it can cause neurological damage. It's particularly a problem in young children because it can alter brain development, and low levels of lead have been associated with sort of antisocial behaviour in teenagers as well from childhood exposure to lead. And it's not great for growing brains to be exposed to lead because it lowers the IQ of children. And you can actually see that when there's been a lot of work in New Zealand over time to reduce the amount of lead that people have been exposed to. The lead's come out of paint, it's come out of fuel, and now we're trying to reduce it out of drinking water. They've removed it from the solders and tin cans. And you can actually see the blood lead levels, and blood is how we measure lead levels in New Zealand children, have come down over the last sort of 40 years or so, which is really, really good. And by removing it from the drinking water, that's going to help further.
Yeah. In your opinion, is our current network putting us at risk, and should we be worried about it?
We are very, in a way, we're not as worse off as some other countries. Like in the US, they had a lot of lead piping. For us, it's more where you've got those brass connections or if it's in the tap itself. And what people can do if they're concerned about lead in drinking water is if you come home from work or first thing in the morning, if no water's been running through your taps, you just dump about a mug full of water or up to a couple of mugs full of water before you take drinking water. And that's one way to reduce the lead exposure. Just let the tap run a little bit, particularly if you're going to fill up your drinking water bottle or make up a baby's bottle, then you want to have run the water and then take the fresh water that hasn't been sitting in contact with any lead-containing component.
Are there certain people or types of houses that are more at risk than others?
I think that's a bit hard to tell because, and that's the good thing about the new rig, is because it now applies to both new builds and if you replace your tapware. And it's a bit hard to know what people have done with their tapware in their homes.
Yeah. Is this law going far enough? Are there things that are still missing? The law says that it's reducing the acceptable level of lead in drinking water to 0.25%. Is any lead at all acceptable in our drinking water?
Well, sorry. The lead is actually to do with the tapware. Our limit in drinking water is actually 10 micrograms per litre, so it's quite a low concentration. But lead is one of those toxicants that we want to keep our exposure to as low as possible.
Right. Now, are there things missing in the law?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'm really supportive of this move to lower the lead levels in our taps to as low as possible. It just adds to all the other great measures that have been done to protect our community from lead exposure, and particularly small children.
Yeah. Are there other contaminants of concern that we should also be trying to legislate against?
Oh, I have many.
Yeah.
So that's probably quite a complicated. What I would actually like us to do is have a better understanding of what people are being exposed to in their everyday lives through all their consumer products, and then working out which ones we think are okay and then which ones we think we need to regulate and maybe which ones we need to ban.
That was Professor Sally Gore of the University of Canterbury, speaking about the government's recent rule changes on the use of lead for all new drinking water pipes.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho taka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Dr. Kushla McGovern, National MP Ryan Hamilton, University of Otago researcher Max Harvey, the University of Auckland's Lucy Goodman, and the University of Canterbury's Professor Sally Gore. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up, we've got the 1-4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. go to 95bfm.com/signup.